very foundation of our modern world, what we call peace, is actually a constant low-intensity war. And what if capitalism isn't just involved in war, but is war conducted by other means? That's not just a provocative statement. It's the core challenge we're diving into today here on The Deep Dive. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're unpacking a truly paradigm-shifting book, Wars and Capital by Eric Aliez and Maurizio Lazzarato. We've pored over comprehensive summaries and, well, our own deep dive notes to bring you their radical thesis. Our mission is to understand how these thinkers argue that war and capital are not separate, occasional events, but an inseparable fundamental unity, with war serving as the permanent condition and driving force of capitalist accumulation. This isn't just abstract theory. It's about handing you a new lens, really, to interpret everything from global headlines to your own daily experiences.
Yeah. And what's truly fascinating here, and why this deep dive is so crucial for you, the listener, is that this perspective, it doesn't just reshape our understanding of large-scale geopolitical conflicts. It forces a radical reevaluation of your everyday life. You know, how you work, what you consume, even how you manage your personal finances. This isn't just about gaining knowledge quickly. It's about fundamentally changing how you interpret political crises, economic instability, and even those persistent pressures you feel on a daily basis.
Okay, so let's jump right into this then. The core argument from Aliez and Lazzarato is, well, quite frankly, revolutionary. They push past the idea that war is just an occasional instrument capitalism uses, or maybe some external shock to the system. Instead, they contend that capitalism is war, an ongoing permanent state of conflict.
Right. It's the very engine, the internal logic, and the primary mode of operation for capital itself. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, they're arguing that those traditional sort of comfortable distinctions between war and peace, or between military and civilian life, they effectively collapse. We're living in what they call an era of total war, or interval war, where the relentless need for constant expansion and profit requires the perpetual creation of enemies. And think of it not just as nations clashing on battlefields, right? But as pervasive wars against labor, against social movements, against the environment, even against democratic institutions. It's a challenging idea. It really moves beyond both the liberal view of capitalism as this, you know, naturally peaceful system, and maybe even traditional Marxist analyses that might treat war as somehow external to economic production.
So when you say ontologically inseparable, just for our listeners, that means these two things, capitalism and war, they aren't just linked or connected, but they are fundamentally part of each other's very being, their existence. Is that right? Like two sides of the same coin, not just two separate things interacting.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it. It's a deep philosophical claim they're making. For Aliez and Lazzarato, capitalism's core processes, things like accumulation, investment, competition, innovation, are merely analogous to war. They are war. Finance, logistics, cutting-edge technology, and even debt. These are presented as primary weapons. Weapons in a permanent global civil war waged by capital against populations, against collective well-being, and against what we understand as shared life.
Wow. That's a truly radical stance. It makes you wonder, who are these individuals bold enough to challenge our understanding of peace and capitalism so profoundly? First up, we have Eric Aliez, a distinguished French philosopher. He's known for significant contributions to continental philosophy, political philosophy, aesthetics, and critical theory. And he's also a renowned scholar of Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari philosophers, known for concepts like the war machine.
Yeah.
Right. Now, for those maybe unfamiliar, the war machine isn't just about armies, right? It describes something more like a decentralized fluid force.
Exactly. Something that constantly innovates, breaks down existing structures, and operates outside conventional state power. Aliez brings this deep conceptual rigor to their project.
Okay. And the other author?
Then there's Maurizio Lazzarato. He's an Italian sociologist and philosopher, prominent in the Italian autonomous movement. He's done some really groundbreaking work on concepts like immaterial labor, you know, the work of ideas, communication, relationships, not just physical goods.
Right. Immaterial labor.
And machinic capitalism, which looks at how technology and social organization create new forms of control. He's also really known for The Making of the Indebted Man, focusing on how debt isn't just financial, but deeply shapes our identity, our consciousness, and our social relations.
This raises an important question then. What makes them, this specific pair, uniquely positioned to write this? Their collaboration sounds like a powerful synergy.
Oh, absolutely. It's a remarkable combination, really. Aliez brings that high-level, you could say abstract, conceptual toolkit of French post-structuralist philosophy. That lets them deconstruct foundational ideas about power and society.
Okay, the big picture philosophy.
Right. And Lazzarato, on the other hand, offers a grounded analysis of the concrete mechanisms of contemporary capitalism, things like the pervasive role of debt and the changing nature of labor. So Allais provides the theoretical scaffold, maybe, for understanding capital as this war machine, while Lazzarato shows us how that machine operates through the lived experience of finance and work.
I see.
They combine deep theoretical knowledge with firsthand experience from social movements and political activism. That allows them to analyze both the abstract mechanisms of capitalist warmaking and their very real concrete effects on everyday life.
That's a really powerful intellectual foundation. So, okay, how do they trace the evolution of this war capital nexus? You said they take us on a journey, not just through theory, but through history, showing this wasn't some sudden thing, but a deeply embedded historical process.
Yeah, exactly. They argue that capitalism, for its very origins, represents a unique fusion. A fusion of Deleuze and Guattari's war machine, that force of creative destruction we just touched upon, constantly pushing boundaries, dissolving old orders, and an apparatus of capture that then tries to harness that energy, that destruction, and channel it directly into accumulation.
An apparatus of capture.
Right. And this process isn't new. It's evolved from early colonial ventures right up to what, you know, we might now identify as disaster capitalism.
Okay, can you give us maybe a more concrete historical example of how this apparatus of capture works, especially in those early colonial ventures they mentioned? How does that creative destruction get captured for capital?
Sure. Well, think about primitive accumulation. This wasn't, as some economists might suggest, like a one-time event to kickstart capitalism dispossessing peasants or the initial colonial land grabs. They argue it's the permanent model. Capitalism constantly wages war, sometimes violently, sometimes through subtler means, to create and secure new markets, extract resources, and exploit labor.
So like the enclosures in England, where common lands were privatized, is that an example?
That's a perfect example. That was, in their view, a war waged against traditional ways of life to create a landless workforce for emerging industries. That energy, that disruption was captured. They also dive into historical examples like the 30 Years' War in the 17th century. They see it as a kind of historical archetype where mercenary armies and their financiers forged a new model of privatized, profitable violence.
Privatized?
Yeah. These weren't just state-controlled wars. Private contractors, driven by profit, became central. This model then became integral to the modern world system. Colonial conquests, in this view, weren't just about expansion. They were laboratories, really. Developing techniques of total war against populations deemed other. Techniques that were later refined and even re-imported back into Europe itself.
That's a chilling thought that war could be so privatized and profitable so early on. Okay, so then we move into the 20th century. The world wars created this unprecedented fusion of industry and military. But then something counterintuitive happens. The rise of the welfare state. How do they fit that into this war capital narrative? Was it a retreat from war? Or
far from it, actually, in their analysis. The post-war welfare state is reframed not as a true peace dividend, but as a strategic truce.
A truce?
Yeah, a way to continue the war internally, but through different means. By managing the population through social security, public health, education, the state was effectively engaging in what they call biopolitical control.
Okay, and this biopolitical control, for listeners who might not be familiar, can you quickly explain what that entails in simple terms? Is it about managing populations like a resource?
Precisely, yeah. Biopolitical control means governing life itself. It's about managing populations through statistics, public health initiatives, social programs, not necessarily for their liberation, but to optimize them as a productive force. It was a way to discipline the workforce, integrate it more deeply into the logic of production, and manage potential unrest, thereby acting as a continuous, albeit non-military, form of internal warfare against dissent or any collective lives not aligned with capital.
Wow. Okay, so that's the historical sweep. How does this look in our contemporary world? Allais and Lazzarato argue that neoliberalism from the 1970s onwards wasn't just an economic shift, but a declaration of a new, more insidious kind of war.
Right.
What are the modern battlefronts they identify?
Well, one of the most crucial modern battlefronts, they argue, is financial warfare. And debt is its primary weapon.
Debt as a weapon.
Yes, this is critical. They assert, quite starkly, that debt is the new weapon of mass destruction. Financial instruments become the means for disciplining societies and individuals. Think about the Greek financial crisis, right? Where austerity measures imposed by international lenders reshaped an entire nation.
Right, I remember that vividly.
Or structural adjustment programs in developing countries, even predatory lending practices that target vulnerable populations. These are all case studies of how debt transfers wealth upward. And it creates compliant, anxious subjects. It's not just economic, it's a war on political imagination, foreclosing alternative possibilities and binding populations to existing power relations through the perpetual burden of repayment.
That reframing of debt is really chilling. It makes you think about student loans or even a mortgage completely differently. So how does this debt as a weapon operate specifically on an individual level?
Well, on an individual level, it fosters what Lazzarato calls the indebted man. Or indebted person, we should say. Your future is essentially mortgaged. Your present is consumed by servicing that debt. This makes you less likely to take risks, challenge authority, or, you know, engage in collective action because your immediate survival and solvency are constantly at stake. You become an anxious, disciplined subject, always managing your financial obligations, which ultimately serves the system.
Right. So that's one front. What else?
Another critical front in this war is the capture of subjectivity itself. Contemporary capitalism, they argue, actively captures and controls you at a deeper level.
Subjectivity, like our thoughts and feelings.
Exactly. Digital technologies, social media platforms, algorithmic governance, they create new forms of subjugation. What might appear as participation online, like sharing content or leaving reviews, often functions as unpaid labor. And it shapes consciousness and desire in ways that serve capitalist interests. The book argues neoliberalism has turned everyone into an entrepreneur of the self.
Ah, that phrase again.
Yeah. An isolated soldier responsible for their own survival in a brutal, atomized war of all against all. You're constantly pressured to invest in your human capital, to optimize your performance, to outcompete others, often just to stay afloat.
So when they say entrepreneur of the self, it's not just a buzzword then. It's about taking the logic of the market and applying it to your entire identity, your relationships, your free time. It's like that pressure to constantly brand ourselves on social media, be available 24/7, turn hobbies into side hustles. Is that the kind of thing they mean?
Exactly that. It's about turning every aspect of your life into a measurable, optimizable project. Your personal network becomes social capital, your health regimen and an investment, your leisure, just a recharge for more efficient work. This internalizes the competitive pressures of capitalism, making it feel like an individual struggle rather than a systemic one.
Okay, wow. And there's a third front.
Yes. Finally, they highlight logistics as military strategy, how contemporary capitalism organizes production, circulation, consumption, almost like military operations against working populations. Systems like just-in-time production, complex global supply chain management, and the gig economy represent forms of warfare. Warfare that disciplines labor through precarity and constant reorganization. The COVID-19 pandemic, for example, starkly revealed the military character of supply chains, didn't it? And the treatment of many workers as essentially disposable resources, creating what they term social death for populations deemed surplus.
So when my Amazon package arrives in 2 days, it's not just efficient delivery. It's potentially part of a strategic maneuver in this ongoing war. That's quite a shift in perspective. Can you elaborate maybe on how the gig economy specifically fits this military strategy model?
Sure. Well, in the gig economy, workers are atomized, right? They're stripped of traditional employee protections, treated as independent contractors. This creates an army, you could say, of highly flexible, disposable labor, constantly competing against each other for tasks. The algorithms that assign jobs, track performance, determine pay. They function like a decentralized command structure, monitoring and disciplining this army of workers. It's a highly efficient system for capital because it externalizes costs and transfers all the risk onto the individual worker, which is, you know, a classic military strategy. Exploit the front lines while protecting the command center.
Okay, that really hits home. Does your daily commute, your online browsing, your monthly bills, or that constant pressure to optimize yourself, does it now feel a bit less like normal life and more like a skirmish? It truly forces you to reevaluate those everyday pressures that feel so internal and personal. So, all right, what does this all mean for you, the listener, in your daily life? The book offers this profound lens for interpreting our world, revealing the violence embedded in events often portrayed as neutral or purely technical.
Yeah, I think one of the most fundamental insights is their inversion of Clausewitz's famous dictum. You know, Clausewitz said, "War is the continuation of politics by other means."
Right.
Allais and Lazzarato flip that. They argue, war is not the continuation of politics by other means, but rather politics and economics are the continuation of war, peace is a moment in a permanent war.
Wow.
This challenges us to see parliamentary debates or economic policies not as expressions of peace, but as tactical maneuvers within a permanent conflict. It means the underlying condition of our capitalist society is one of conflict, not an absence of it.
That's a huge shift. What's another key insight?
Another one is their concept of a security society. They contend that security is not protection from threats, but the preemptive organization of social life around the management of risk. This shows how measures justified as protection, things like increased surveillance, data collection, maybe even certain public health protocols, often function as mechanisms of control. And they can actually generate the very threats they claim to address, thereby justifying further intervention and consolidation of power.
Creating the problem it claims to solve.
Kind of, yeah. And critically, they argue that capitalism does not produce commodities. It produces subjectivity. This highlights how capitalism increasingly captures and exploits our very capacities for communication, cooperation, creativity, shaping us into subjects aligned with its imperatives.
So it's not just about what you buy, but who you become within the system.
Exactly. It's deeper.
Those are powerful inversions of common understanding. So what are some real-life applications? How might this reframing change how we interact with our world?
Well, for a practical example, think about how this reframes personal and student debt. As we touched on, it's not just a personal failing or some neutral economic tool. It's a systemic instrument of social control, a form of indentured servitude almost. From this perspective, advocating for debt cancellation becomes less about charity and more about an act of liberation, an act of resistance. It's about dismantling a weapon.
That shifts the entire conversation around debt.
Definitely.
What about how we interpret the news day to day?
Well, you might start viewing corporate mergers not just as business deals, but as acts of annexation, consolidating territory and power. An austerity budget might be seen as an act of economic aggression against a population, or international trade agreements as treaties establishing the terms of economic warfare. It gives you a critical filter.
Okay, a new lens for current events.
And in the workplace, as we discussed, the gig economy, zero-hour contracts, constant performance reviews, these can be understood as techniques of military-style discipline in a decentralized labor market. This perspective helps explain why work often feels like a battle for survival, you know, a constant struggle for precarious existence rather than just a way to earn a living. Yeah, I think this deep dive into wars and capital provides a fundamentally transformed understanding of our world. For me, the most valuable insight is this. If the system is truly a war machine, then the violence we see from financial crises to environmental degradation to the constant pressures of daily life isn't a malfunction. It's not a bug.
It's a feature.
Exactly. It's the system operating perfectly according to its own warlike logic. And this recognition can be incredibly liberating in a strange way, because it suggests that these crises cannot be resolved through mere reform. Instead, they require a fundamental transformation of social relations, a questioning of the very peace that hides the ongoing war.
It was a really profound observation and something to really chew on. If capitalism is war and power is so diffuse, so embedded in seemingly neutral infrastructure like our financial systems or digital platforms, then where do we even begin to look for the front lines in our own lives? It feels overwhelming.
It can, yeah.
But maybe this isn't just about opposing power. It's about the hard work of creating alternative forms of life-building cooperative structures, mutual aid networks, new ways of organizing society based on care and solidarity rather than perpetual conflict. A challenging but maybe essential insight to carry forward after this deep dive. Thank you for joining us. So if peace is merely a temporary ceasefire in capital's relentless campaign, what does that mean for our pursuit of genuine lasting peace? And how does recognizing this war economy give us a more accurate map for action in our own lives and communities?